G'day, folks. Talk to Dr. Murray Weber, a paediatrician staff specialist in the child and family health team in Newcastle. We talked about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD, and how it affects the child, the mother, the family, the dynamics of that, and the spectrum of what it looks like for the child at one end or the other, and also diagnosis. Polarizing stuff. Really great yarn. I want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, best electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be riding in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs. Oh
yeah. Dr. Murray Weber.
Yes.
Thanks for sitting down with us today and just having a, well, we're looking at having a discussion about FASD and fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and just what that is in its entirety and just your background knowledge in it and what your profession is. So
yep.
If you don't mind, doctor, just kicking it off, just who you are and your profession and sort of where that all started from and then we can jump into a bit of the FASD stuff.
So thanks, Jake. It's a great pleasure to chat to you today about FASD. I am a doctor and I'm trained as a paediatrician. So I'm a specialist in child health. And I guess I've been a doctor since 1991 when this hospital closed down, actually. So it's a long time ago now. And then I finished my training to be a specialist paediatrician in 2002. So I've been working as a specialist here in Newcastle since 2004. I spent a couple of years away during my training, then came back in 2004, and I've been working here as mainly a general and developmental paediatrician for Hunter New England Local Health District.
Yeah, great. And do you mind just giving us a brief history on this facility and what goes on here?
So where we're sitting now is in what's called the Child and Family Health Team, which essentially is a child development unit, like child development units around Australia. It's a public outpatient service, a multidisciplinary service that provides assessments for children and families where through the public sector, so it's free, and it's for kids that are referred to us where there are concerns in multiple domains about their development.
Yep.
So that includes behaviour and cognitive impairments, language, motor skills and so forth, and where kids need assessment primarily and a diagnostic assessment and then some management advice into the future, and hopefully it allows them to access things like educational supports and disability supports where they qualify for those.
That's great.
But I guess primarily, you know, it's to help the kids and their families understand their child's development and ideally what may have been the cause.
Yep.
And if there's any, you know, anything that might be done to ameliorate that. But most kids, their development is not something that can be cured. This is a trajectory that they're on.
Yeah. And talking about the child's development and understanding that, so can you just tell us about FASD and how that affects the child going through birth and just the whole trajectory line of that through the developmental stage?
So FASD is something that we know much more about now than we did perhaps 15 or 20 years ago even. The term FASD means fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, and it's an umbrella term that covers the full range of child developmental outcomes and disabilities that kids may have where they'd been exposed to alcohol during their mother's pregnancy as a fetus. And I think it's important to understand that you can't have FASD unless your mother's drunk alcohol in pregnancy, but also the level of disability is very unpredictable. So the amount of alcohol doesn't necessarily determine the outcome. Not necessarily.
Okay.
There's a lot of factors that come into play.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, the more alcohol you're exposed to, the more severe the impairments. That's, you know, the best way of understanding it, and that there's no safe level of alcohol exposure. I think we often talk about FASD as being a hidden disability because a lot of the disabilities that kids have can be quite subtle and difficult to identify, and they don't fit in easily recognisable patterns.
Yeah, okay.
Because alcohol can, a fetus can be exposed to alcohol at any stage of the pregnancy, and so it means that any area of fetal development may be affected, and all of the developmental domains may in fact be affected by alcohol.
So can you sort of gauge once the child is born and say they know that the alcohol rating throughout the child might be X, Y, and Z, can you sort of get a trajectory of maybe, you know, forecasting the child's development, that it might be fit in this end of the spectrum of FASD or the other spectrum? So
sometimes you may be able to do that, but in fact that's quite rare. I think where people have identified during a woman's pregnancy that she has drunk harmful levels of alcohol, so people know in advance, they know how much someone has drunk, and particularly if they're very high levels, and then if a baby is born with very clear physical signs or illness that reflects alcohol poisoning in utero, it may be possible then to predict that that child, the predominant problem for them has been alcohol exposure. But that's quite a rare occurrence. I think it's much more common for people not to be aware of a mother's drinking behaviour in pregnancy, and for a baby, even if they are affected or it's, you know, they have recognisable alcohol-related findings at birth, for people to miss those or not be able to make that link at birth because they don't have that history of exposure. And there's a lot of things that look like fetal alcohol syndrome or spectrum disorders too. So it's almost a diagnosis of exclusion. You have to rule out all the other things that could be the cause in many cases.
Yep. So with FASD, with the spectrum from, say, base to the other end of the spectrum, can you just talk a bit about that and, you know, how it physically and mentally is impacted on the individual and how their behavioural patterns are or just their motor skills or visual skills and
There's a whole range of things that might happen. I think maybe as a starting point, I might just explain what our current diagnostic criteria are. So in Australia, we now use the Australian FASD guidelines that came out in 2016, and they're a very helpful guide for health professionals like me to systematically look at child development and work out what role alcohol may have played in a child's developmental outcomes. And so what we look at are the level of alcohol exposure, and we use standardised questionnaires. There's one called the AUDIT-C that is recommended for measuring alcohol exposure. And then we look at the child, we look at physical impairments that they may have, and then we look at 10 neurodevelopmental domains. So in the most severely affected kids, they'll have physical findings that include what we call the three sentinel facial features.
Yeah, that's what I've heard about, and that's what I wanted to touch on. So just what the facial features are and how you can determine what sort of level that they sit at.
So they can be a bit subtle and hard for people to detect as well, particularly newborn babies. But essentially, we know that alcohol affects facial development in utero. And so particularly in the first trimester, where a lot of our organs and body structures are being formed, high levels of alcohol can affect things like the size of our eyes and then facial features such as our lip development. So the thickness of our upper lip and the what's called the philtrum, which is this area between the nose and the lip, which normally has a lovely double peak.
Yep.
But in babies that are poisoned by alcohol, that doesn't develop normally and you get a very flat philtrum.
Yeah, is that sort of like a cleft sort of as well babies, in their lips? Or?
Well, no, it's not exactly like a cleft, but babies with fetal alcohol poisoning can actually have cleft palates and cleft lips as well if the alcohol has affected the development of the palate and the lip. So what we do recognise, however, is that children with high levels of alcohol exposure are much more likely to have these small, what we call palpable fissures, so the eye slit where our eyeball fits, and then a flat philtrum and a thin upper lip, or vermilion border is the other name. So these are the three, what we call sentinel facial features for the kids that are most severely affected by alcohol in utero. But most children don't have that, even when they've been exposed to alcohol. That was one of the earliest descriptions of alcohol-related birth defects, which goes back to 1973 when a...
Was that when 1973 when FASD was first recognised?
That's when fetal alcohol syndrome was first recognised, and that was the syndrome of facial features and growth retardation and cognitive and other developmental problems. So that's the severe end of the spectrum.
Yep.
Nowadays, we talk about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and we capture all of the milder areas of where kids are affected, which are, you know, don't include physical impairments, but do include all the neurodevelopmental problems. And so we now look at things like their brain structure and size, things like motor skills, cognition, so the ability to solve problems and learn. Language development is probably the most commonly affected area. So kids with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder are most likely to present in early childhood with delayed language development. When they get to school, they're likely to have great problems with academic achievement and learning. Mm. Then we look at specific areas like memory, attention, what we call executive function. So that's the higher order decision making that we have as humans.
And talking about emotional learning, so through the education system, is FASD, like, are they aware where some teachers can recognise if that kid's maybe mucking up or because of their...
Good question.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that.
Mm.
My impression is that a lot of teachers would not really be aware of the impact of alcohol and FASD and how prevalent it probably is.
Mm.
They may increasingly be having kids coming into their classrooms who do have the diagnosis, and I guess they'll be learning about the effects of FASD through the kids that they're being exposed to. But on the whole, I think the education system's probably a lot further behind than even the health sector is about understanding. And that's a problem, of course, because they're the ones providing the educational support and needs. As far as I'm aware, FASD itself is not a disability that's recognised by the education sector.
Okay.
But it certainly is now recognised through, for example, the NDIS as a disability requiring support.
Yeah, it's pretty complex, with the whole spectrum. And talking about the complexities of it, so when you're getting down the other end of the spectrum, when you were talking about FASD, where it affects, you know, physically as well with the motor skills, because you didn't call it fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, you called it
fetal alcohol syndrome.
So if you want to explain that.
I guess there's a whole range of possible physical abnormalities. So in the more severely affected kids, as I mentioned, they will have growth problems, so they'll be smaller. And in fact...
Is that due to being premature as well?
They might be premature, but it's a direct effect of alcohol on growth. And there's been lots of studies and research that shows that alcohol retards growth in all organisms. So whether you're you know, do studies on animals, or I saw a lovely study, it was an educational tool looking at like sea monkeys, little shrimps. It was an experiment comparing ones with a small amount of alcohol in the fluid they were growing in and not, and it was a very clear difference. So there was an increased number in of these little shrimps that died, and also they were all smaller. So we know it impairs growth. But then there's some specific physical things that can happen. As I mentioned, the facial malformations, there can be things like cleft palates and so forth. There can be congenital heart problems, kidney disorders, bony dysplasias as well. So quite a lot of things. But then in relation to motor development, which is it's actually how you use your body after you're born, a lot of kids will have, although it's probably the least frequently involved area of development, some kids will have problems with motor development, so delayed, you know, rolling, sitting, crawling and walking perhaps, and they may as adults be a little bit more clumsy with their motor skills.
To the point maybe where they need wheelchairs or anything like that, or walking aids, or
perhaps I guess if they have a severe neurological impairment, then it's possible. I guess I haven't seen that level of motor disability where someone can't walk due to alcohol exposure, but I guess it's potentially a problem.
So especially in your field, because what is the range of kids that you work with personally?
So our service here is kids from essentially 2 years of age up until 12 years of age, up to the end of primary school. And they're referred to us where there are multiple areas of concern with their development. We generally would see kids who don't meet disability criteria before they get to see us. So for someone, for example, that's in a wheelchair or has a recognised syndrome, like Down syndrome, for example, they're not kids that our service would see, because they get diverted into the disability sector and support services before they come to us, so they can access the things they need. It tends to be kids on the milder end of the spectrum generally, where people don't understand their development, conditions like autism, for example, or FASD, or other complex combinations where perhaps kids come from a disadvantaged background. We see a lot of kids in out-of-home care, for example, where there may be developmental trauma and neglect, and that can also have a big impact on a range of areas of their development too. So we see a mixture of kids, but it's a public free clinical service, and so I guess we focus more on families that don't have the resources to use the private sector as well.
And down the milder end of the spectrum, or even if you want to take us through from the milder to up the other end of the scale, so what's a typical sort of behavioural patterns that you see with some of these kids?
Look, we get lots of kids referred to us with undifferentiated behavioural problems. So they are not coping in the school environment, for example, or at home, and people are not sure why. So they could be, problems with concentration, attention, organisation. They may be emotional issues, so having problems with emotional regulation. Some of that may be driven by high levels of anxiety, or sometimes even depression for young kids, which is a common complication for FASD. And then a lot of those behaviours may fit within patterns that are recognised, like ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, or at the more severe end, conduct disorder, where kids are, doing things to other people, like injuring them or stealing or lighting fires and things like that. So at the more severe end, you might get quite disruptive behaviours that impact on their capacity to function in life and participate in schooling, for example.
So we need a lot of supports around.
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah, and talking about supports, so we've got your profession, and other professions that are going to come through, because I'm thinking of speech, speech pathology and occupational therapy. Yes. So are they sort of the other professions that have to be involved along the way?
I think at both the assessment and therapy phases, FASD requires a multidisciplinary team. Now, exactly how many people are needed depends on resources available and the impacts on a particular child. But I think most individuals with FASD deserve a thorough assessment to determine the level of their disability and what kind of supports they need. And that really does require a number of people having a look at them. So doctors are quite good at an overall view of someone's health and then focusing on etiology and tests and investigations that can help sort out what might be going on. So you do need to have a doctor involved, and in childhood, generally speaking, a paediatrician is a good good place to start or to go to next when you need to get someone with the expertise in FASD. But then, of course, people with FASD are going to come into contact with all kinds of other health professionals. Through a multidisciplinary assessment, you're likely to need a psychologist. Psychologists are very good at understanding development and, in particular, understanding brain functioning and cognition, and have a range of different tools that they can use to assess kids.
So does it have to be any sort of specific psychologist in a sense? Because I hear of neuropsychologists and
that's a good question. Look, I guess neuropsychologists would be the most ideal, but there's not many neuropsychologists around. They would have probably the best training and access to the kind of testing that might be helpful. So ideally a neuropsychologist, but of course if you can't find a neuropsychologist, a clinical psychologist that, in particular if you're talking about kids like our people we see, someone that has expertise in child development and the tools that help assess cognition in young kids. But then of course you mentioned occupational therapists and speech pathologists, and I think an assessment's not complete without looking at language development and speech in children, and ideally that should be done by someone that knows how to assess that well, and a speech pathologist is trained to look at language development in kids. An occupational therapist has great skills in looking at motor development in kids, both fine and gross motor, and they can examine those areas and find out if there is a problem and what might need to be done to help and support that area of disability. That's just in the health sector.
Yeah.
And of course, outside of health, I mean, kids may come across all kinds of people within health. They may end up in an emergency department, see nursing staff and all kinds of people. But outside of health, of course, we've talked about education, and I think all kids, because education is compulsory, all kids with FASD are going to end up in the education system somewhere. And that's sometimes the first time people identify that there's a problem, because the kids are not learning and they're not coping emotionally with the social interactions at school. And people often struggle to understand why that might be, or even to consider that perhaps there could be a cause like fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So sometimes these kids never get a diagnosis or never get referred for an assessment. Despite us, I guess, now recognising that this could be the issue.
Yep.
Yeah. And then the disability sector, of course, is the other area where kids who meet criteria for disability services will come into contact with people providing supports.
Mm. Yeah, because it's good that the NDIS and other disability service providers are starting to become more aware of FASD and what it is and how to provide the right services for a lot of the kids or adults out there that have FASD.
Yeah, I agree.
But with FASD in Australia, where did the recognition of it really start kicking off and gaining momentum?
Look, I guess since 1973, people have been aware of fetal alcohol syndrome. So people have known in the health sector for how many years is that? 45 years or more, that alcohol is damaging to fetuses. So at the severe end of the spectrum, I think we've known for a long time. At the milder end of the spectrum, I think it's taken us taken longer for people to be aware about how insidious this problem is. And we're still coming to terms with the prevalence of the condition. We still don't really know how many people are affected by fetal alcohol exposure in Australia. The best estimates are at least 1% of people, and that's a lot of people if you think about it. 1%
that
of people.
That is a lot, yeah.
Closer to 2% is probably more accurate, and there are some estimates of maybe as high as 5%. It could be as high as 5% of the population, which if you think about it would be...
That's huge.
Huge. But I think it's fair to say that at least 1% on current estimates, and probably more.
And through research or just general knowledge, what communities are mostly recognised to have FASD and why?
So a lot of the research into the effects of alcohol have been focused on populations of people where we know the risk is likely to be higher. And so that includes in some of the remote Aboriginal communities where there are high rates of drinking behaviour, and Fitzroy Crossing in the Kimberley is a very, I guess, infamous location now where I think it's reported to have the world's highest levels of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And that's obviously a great tragedy, but that's a tiny number of people. In reality, and there are other populations at high risk, I guess, so we're looking at kids in out-of-home care, for example, and so they've been placed in out-of-home care often because of exposure to domestic violence. Often there can be problem drinking as well associated with that, and it's quite likely that a lot of those kids have been exposed to alcohol in utero, and there are some estimates that up to 60% of children out of home care have been exposed to alcohol in utero, for example.
That's pretty high, 60%.
Yeah. Other populations, I guess in developmental services like this, we would expect a high percentage in special school or support areas in schooling. Juvenile justice, I think, is the other area that we have increasingly recognised has high rates of people incarcerated due to fetal alcohol exposure as well.
Yeah.
But I think the most important message is that even when you take into consideration all of those people, most of the people affected by FASD don't come from those backgrounds. So although they have high rates, they're relatively small populations of people, and in fact there are likely to be far more people affected who don't come from high-risk populations because of the prevalence of drinking behaviour amongst our population generally.
Yeah, because a lot of the research you were saying is up northwest, but is there much really done in New South Wales, particularly in the Cicada unit maybe that's in Westmead in Sydney?
So we are now rolling out more assessment and diagnostic services, I think, around the country. And the Cicada Clinic is the New South Wales funded program based at Westmead, and they see people for diagnostic assessments. Mm. And I guess when we're thinking about understanding the prevalence around the country, there are studies underway, and there's one that's run by what's called the Australian Paediatric Surveillance Unit. So paediatricians like me report new diagnoses to them. So we're gathering more and more information on a national level.
Mm.
I'm sure as increasing diagnoses happen through specialist services, as they're becoming more available, we'll actually have more evidence and better understanding about how many people really are affected. But it's taking a lot of time, and we don't really have enough services to see all the people referred currently.
Yeah, I was going to say that, because when you're talking about 60% and some of these numbers that are rising up, and where that
become
more prevalent,
1% of all Australians,
especially New South Wales, like some of the numbers that are here, and just having trying to get the professionals on board like yourself to do these assessments.
100,000 births in New South Wales every year, and if you assume that, you know, at least 1%, so that's 1,000 kids a year need an assessment somewhere to confirm a diagnosis.
Yeah.
But it's probably more than that.
Jeez. And just with the assessments, sort of what is the actual assessment itself? Like, how long does it sort of take? And are the diagnostic tests or tools called anything like the as in name wise for a certain diagnostic tool or assessment?
So look, I mentioned the Australian FASD guidelines that came out 3 years ago. So that's a nice, clear process for systematically examining all the areas of a child's development and growth and so forth that helps guide us make a diagnosis. An assessment can be quick or long. It really depends on the level of disability, so how apparent someone's disability might be. So the more severe, more likely to get a diagnosis early. And whether you have all the information you need at the beginning. So if I see someone that has already seen a speech pathologist, already seen an occupational therapist, already had a psychological assessment or a cognitive assessment performed, and I've got a history of, a good history of alcohol intake during pregnancy, then it's quite straightforward. My job really is just to try and work out the severity, I guess, of the areas of disability and to rule out other either comorbid problems or other possible causes for the child's development. But it may not take a long time to make a diagnosis, but it's always a little bit complex. And if you don't have all that information, it can take quite a long time to gather it. One of the biggest problems is finding a history of alcohol exposure. If you don't have that, and if you don't have the physical features of fetal alcohol syndrome, the three sentinel facial features, you can't really make a diagnosis of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, even if you've got severe impairments. So finding that history, I think, is one of the biggest challenges for a whole range of reasons. Often because it's just not available. A child may be living in a foster care placement and nobody actually knows about a mum's drinking behaviour. Or, of course, mums may not want to tell us when we ask them. And that's understandable, particularly if they understand the implications of their drinking and the fact that perhaps, people may blame them for the outcome for their child. And that can be quite emotionally challenging for people to confront.
It is. Because you'd have some of the parents that, where they're just not aware of the impacts
of
what the alcohol does to the child, or where the parents themselves, they might have FASD or there might be some sort of systemic cycle that they've been going through with life and growing up, and where they're just not aware of any of that. So
A whole range of things can happen during a woman's pregnancy that can influence that behaviour, and you're quite right that I think there's probably a knowledge issue for many women. Even though we try to inform women about how to have a healthy pregnancy, most women know about smoking, but I'm not sure that they all understand truly the impact of drinking alcohol.
Yeah. And with some of the assessments, because now I know the health services out there throughout the nation, and especially when it gets to more remote locations, they're looking at doing diagnostic tools or assessments via video links.
Yes.
So can that be done? Can FASD be clinically assessed through video link if it's a remote area instead of flying in clinical psychologists?
Look, it might be possible. We're increasingly using telehealth to provide services to remote locations. I guess I'm not an expert in telehealth. I don't currently use telehealth clinically.
Okay.
But I'm certainly aware that many people do, and they do it successfully. And I don't think there's any real reason why it couldn't be used, but there are challenges, definitely. And I think you need to have a clinician at the patient end of the video conference, the telehealth conference, that can actually follow up on some of the things that need to be done. You'll need to have a doctor, I think, there to see them and physically examine someone as well. And you may need to have someone to take a photograph of their face, for example, in a way that you can perform facial measurements to determine if they've got the facial features of fetal alcohol syndrome. So there is a lot of complexity.
Mm.
And you certainly can't do all the assessment tools through a video conference link. So, for example, a lot of the motor assessments require fairly close contact and observation with people, so it may not be possible to complete all the assessments. But if you get enough information, if someone is severely affected and there's enough information and you have a good alcohol exposure history, there's no reason why you couldn't make a diagnosis.
Yeah.
But you may not be able to do a complete assessment like you would for someone that you are in the same room with.
But you do see it as an advantage, like with the telehealth, if it's
as a starting remote point. Starting point to access services, I think it's a good, you know, I think it would be a good initiative to get the ball rolling, and then maybe some outreach services might be required to finish off the assessments, perhaps, or people may have to travel at least on one occasion sometimes.
And just going back to the assessments, like if we're just going to go on average on if it's hours or weeks that have to be put in to get a diagnosis over the line, what's a ballpark for you there?
Look, it's hard for me to answer that because I think it's a spectrum, and I would say that a minimum you could do it in one consultation if other people have already provided a lot of information. But essentially, I would say you'd need at least half a day to be able to gather enough information and examine it adequately and to perform any assessments needed to be able to make a diagnosis. And I think there have been some examples of people organising diagnostic clinics like this. So the team in Western Australia, I think, for example, has rolled out some, quicker assessment processes for people in juvenile justice too, for example, to allow people to access the right diagnosis and disability services. So you can certainly do it in half a day, I think, in some cases, but that requires a lot of information gathering beforehand to make it happen and work.
Yeah. Mm. And talking about WA, it seems like there is a pretty strong presence in general of FASD and the knowledge, and because when I've gone on to the FASD hub, and when you're looking at, because it shows a directory of the amount of psychologists that are involved with FASD, and it looks like probably 70-80% of the professionals are over on the western half of the country.
Yeah, look, I think there's been a lot of leadership around FASD that's come out of the Western Australian group, and James Fitzpatrick, who is a paediatrician over there, and so they, you know, they've been very successful in obtaining grants and in organising services in an efficient way. So they're probably, you know, a good 5 or 10 years ahead of us here on the East Coast in some ways as far as some of that work. But throughout Australia, there's certainly increasing awareness and increasing access to diagnostic services. Up in the Gold Coast, a fellow called Doug Shelton, who's a paediatrician there, is also a bit of a leader, and they've had a diagnostic service through their child development unit that's been operating now for a number of years, and then more recently the Cicada clinic in Sydney that's been up and running for, I guess, at least 3 years now, maybe a bit more.
So how could we go about building up the resources, and would it be along the lines of more grants or just more money into the health departments to get more psychologists trained up in this area of expertise? Because when you're looking at the population on this side of the country compared to Western Australia, like just in Western Sydney alone, is their population's bigger than the NT, South Australia and Tasmania combined. So
I think in many ways, I think training health professionals is the first step. So increasing our knowledge and capabilities is very important. A lot of people with FASD are already interacting with the health services, so it's not like they're out in the community unable to access anything at all. A lot of them are coming to see us already. We're not actually recognising what is going on and not assessing them appropriately. So I think that's been a big problem for us for a long time. I think doctors need to be aware of this. Their antenna needs to be up, and they need to actually be going down the pathway of FASD assessments earlier. And in fact, it may save time and resources down the track. It's possible that can happen. If we actually investing earlier at the beginning, then we may prevent a lot of the adverse health outcomes that we're seeing for people with FASD and preventing a lot of the harm that's occurring for some individuals who don't have a diagnosis and don't know why they have the level of disability that they have, and you know, their families and schools and other people they come in contact are not aware of what the problem is.
Yeah, and just the ripple effects if the kids aren't diagnosed, and just how that affects you know, themselves, their family, and
absolutely community. People deserve to know why they are in the situation they're in, and I think we're doing them a great injustice by not allowing them access to appropriate diagnostic services at the right time. But it is still a challenge being able to redirect sparse services towards this area, because it means that then you have to take away services from some other area in order to be providing care. So hopefully it'll save money down the track, but then, you know, for services or diagnostic services like ours, we at the moment can't really meet the demand that's out there.
Yeah, but it's just about spreading that awareness and knowledge of what FASD is. And when you're talking about the numbers coming through, hopefully the department recognises that and tries to gear more professionals down this path of, you know, getting a lot of these kids over the line with the diagnostic tools, and, you know, so they can receive the services that are out there for FASD.
Because we can't cure FASD. No. That's the other thing people need to understand. It's an entirely preventable condition. If women didn't drink in pregnancy at all, it wouldn't exist. But sadly, that's not the current situation, and far too many babies are being affected. And so now, you know, at the current rates, we really need to be able to provide the support services they need.
So what's a general sort of medication or diet or anything like that that gets pushed over into the individuals?
Yeah, look, there's still a lot of research, I guess, into the best interventions to help people from a medical perspective. Lots of people with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder will develop things like anxiety and depression, for example, and that may need to be managed with medications. A large number of kids will present with ADHD as their presenting symptoms, and stimulant medication like Ritalin is commonly used and can be fairly effective and helpful. And then I guess alternative therapies, at this stage there's no sort of proven alternative therapies like diet and nutrition or so forth to help with FASD. I think it's always a problematic area for us in traditional medicine, people will adopt a lot of alternative therapies because we can't cure their problems, and they're looking for whatever they can to help. But at this stage, you know, there is no cure for FASD. There's really only support services and treating comorbid conditions.
So how's it all been with the NDIS? Like, because this is so complex to do with FASD and the recognition of it and really what it is, and trying to explain that to, you know, the local area coordinators or the NDIS and bridging these kids over so they can receive disability supports.
Look, the NDIS has been an extraordinary investment by the Commonwealth Government. You know, I think the first thing I think people need to understand is this is, you know, world leading as far as an innovation to support disability.
Yeah.
It's very ambitious as well.
It is.
And I think,
because how I put it, I think the NDIS is a really good thing, but it's flying the plane and making it at the same time.
Kind of. Look, I've got there's mixed outcomes, I guess. In the early days, Newcastle was a trial site for the NDIS, and it was definitely a honeymoon period. We were, you know, I think there was a lot of investment locally here, and I think there were some good outcomes for people, and there were a lot of resources, which is great. But as time's gone on, there's less resources. The NDIS is now almost universally available across the country. I don't know which areas don't have it yet, but almost all areas now have it, Sydney and so forth. And they're recognising that it is resource intensive, it is very costly, and they're trying to manage the cost blowouts that they're having. What I would say in relation to FASD is that it's recognised by the NDIS as a disability, and quite rightly, they're trying to fund people's needs based on the level of disability. Mm. And so we use other tools on functional outcomes to try and work out exactly what kind of supports and services people might need. I guess I've got quite a lot of confidence that the NDIS is the best system that we've got at the moment.
Yeah, that's great.
I think it's a good thing that it's consumer-driven, because that's going to ideally get the things that people want and need for them.
Mm.
I think there are obviously challenges about not enough funding, but there are also specific things around individuals that make it a challenge. So if you've got a significant cognitive disability or problems with impulse control and decision making, you're going to find it hard to advocate and navigate the system for yourself, and you're going to need help. And so long as you have someone else that is doing that for you, then you should get the right outcomes. You've got another advocate on your behalf. But I'm sure, and across the spectrum, I'm sure there's lots of people who are not getting what they are entitled to from the NDIS because they're not able to advocate for themselves, and somebody else is not able to do it for them. And so that I think is a particular problem for people with cognitive impairments and
that's right.
People with FASD.
Yeah, just having the right person in their corner that can get what their actual disability is, so that the NDIS has got that bulk information so they can get all the disability supports around them for their needs of FASD, which is a tricky one, but we're getting there. And do you think there's enough awareness out there in general and about FASD? No,
definitely not.
No.
I think, if there was enough awareness, it wouldn't exist. Okay,
that's
the bottom line. Yeah. I think if all women knew that drinking in pregnancy was going to damage their fetus, their baby, and the level of harm that it could cause, in an ideal world, they wouldn't drink. Now, of course, there's a whole range of reasons why women do drink, and knowledge is part of the reason, or a lack of knowledge about the harms. But of course, there are other emotional reasons that people self-medicate with alcohol and so forth. And that's a different issue, of course. I think clearly the health profession could know more. And I think the general community could know more. I think, people know, we've got labelling now on some alcohol products that actually clearly state that alcohol is harmful for pregnancy. But I think we're moving towards universal labelling, but at the moment that doesn't exist. So I think there's probably a lot more that can be done to make sure that at point of sale people know. And I think in schools we could do more about educating our young adults around the harms of alcohol.
There was a system through the education department for kids to be aware, can happen if...
Yeah, I know that kids do learn about alcohol through schools.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't know exactly the details and how well it's taught in the school sector, but, I think it is important that our future parents understand exactly what drinking in pregnancy can do. And I think, at a time when they're forming their drinking patterns and behaviour as young adults, also that's a time that we need to be, to make sure that we can access them and they can understand how important this issue is.
And with how important this issue is, with some of the resources out there, what can people out there look into if it's stuff to do with, ringing if it's to do with the NDIS or ringing health professionals, or is there something on the web that they can look up?
There's a lot of information now. You know, the internet obviously is an amazing resource that everyone can access if they can read and they've got IT, you know, they're IT savvy. So look, I think there's a lot there. There are certainly things like the FASD Hub, for example. There's support organisations like NoFASD. You know, across the world, there are similar organisations, in particular in Canada. So Canada probably was ahead of us, well, was ahead of Australia in the recognition of alcohol and FASD effects.
In Is that children. Where it was first coined, like the diagnosis?
I'm not sure, actually. I can't tell you the answer to that. I should know exactly where the first description came from, but certainly the Canadians have been leaders in the diagnostic and assessment and intervention research. So there's a lot of information out there, and people shouldn't have any great difficulty in finding it. And then there's organisations like FARE, for example, F-A-R-E, that looks at research and education around FASD too. That's a very good resource.
Mm. And like you, and with yourself, sorry, being a leader to do with FASD, who are some of the other leaders out there that are either clinical psychologists, researchers, or who's out there around the country that...
Look, there's quite a few people now. I think Professor Liz Elliott here in New South Wales, who has helped set up the Cicada Clinic, and a fellow called Marcel Zimmet, who's the doctor running that service. They both have a great deal of expertise and skill in this area. I mentioned Doug Shelton in the Gold Coast, and James Fitzpatrick on the West Coast there in Perth. But look, there's a lot of people now who have expertise. I think, and the Canadian group too, I've forgotten the name of the psychologist, Susan, I should remember her last name, from the University of Washington she's actually in University of Washington in Seattle in the States.
Seattle,
too,
yep.
That developed the 4-digit diagnostic training code, for example. I think there's, you know, a lot of people around the world, but yeah, I guess the people I mentioned here in Australia would be the ones that I would go to.
Yep.
If you wanted to know more about FASD and the research that's being done in diagnosis and intervention here in Australia.
Yep. Mm. So with a lot of the parents out there, so who would be first point of call if they think, it'd be obviously going to their GP first, like, or
yes,
if they already think their kid might have FASD, just...
Where should they go?
Where should they kick off first stage and then move on from there?
It depends at what stage they are, of course. Mm. I think if once their baby's born, if they've got concerns about their baby's development or about their drinking in pregnancy, there's a couple of people they can go to. Certainly their GP would be a good starting point. Or if they're still involved with early childhood nurses, for example, they'd be another point, you know, port of call for those first couple of years of life. After that, I guess, you know, once kids hit school age, I think really the health sector is where you're going to get a diagnosis. So parents could talk to school counsellors about their child's academic progress, but in the end, they're going to need to see a service like ours or a doctor to get the ball rolling.
Yep. Mm. And talking about a service like yours, I really appreciate the work that you guys are doing here. I think it's really important stuff.
Thank you.
And more importantly, you just sitting down having a yarn with me here now and really explaining what FASD is and the intricacies of it. Just putting awareness out there for people to know what it is, because with the involvement that I've had with my work and in the disability sector, with like particularly First Peoples Disability Network, and just seeing, yeah, FASD is there, but it's not recognised in a lot of fields. So it's good just us having ER now and you really putting it out there of what it is, and you know that we need to get more resources out there, because when you're looking at the percentages, we've got to get yeah, some of these professionals in the rock. Yeah.
It's a big problem, and we've still got a long way to go.
I
very much appreciate, Jake, you taking the time to have a chat to me today, and I hope that this helps in some way, at least informing people about FASD. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Dr. Murray, and yeah, that was really good, so appreciate it, and hopefully we'll get you on Key Rolling again down the road and just see hopefully the good effects of the powerful knowledge of FASD, and, you know, where it can spread that awareness out there, and hopefully there's more professionals on board to get these diagnostic tools over the line and get more kids disability services that they need. So cheers. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Thanks. Yeah.
I really enjoyed the conversation with Dr. Murray Weber. Very informative on all things FASD. And if you want to contact or follow me, you can get me on Instagram at StreetRollingCheetah, or email one word, StreetRollingCheetah@gmail.com. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, best electric wheelchairs in the land, I'm residing in one right now, have been with this brand for nearly a decade now, and wouldn't be riding in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they got other great assistive tech out there also. Get in and have a look. Righto, we'll see you on the next one.